A look at the victims of the National and First Coast opioid epidemic. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, make sure to catch the podcast. Just download the WJCT app. Just ahead, it's our continuing look at the opioid crisis. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, a local CEO heads to Davos, also known as the World Economic Forum. Plus, don't miss the live in-studio performance from organist John Ginty. That and more ahead. But first this hour, it's a continuation of our community thread project here at WJCT as we continue looking at different aspects of the tragedy of the opioid epidemic in this area. According to the American Medical Association, an opioid-addicted baby is born in the U.S. every 19 minutes. This morning, we've got a closer look, also an update on the legal aspects of medication-assisted treatment to opioid addiction and the current science supporting this addiction as a chronic relapsing disease. Right now, we're pleased to welcome Dr. Scott Miles, Medical Director with Coastal Community Behavioral Health in St. Mary's, Georgia. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
And we're talking about the opioid crisis. I'm having trouble pronouncing that word. We're talking about the opioid crisis this morning on the show. We want your calls, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Send your tweets to at Melissa and Jax, emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or weigh in on Facebook. And just last week, we spoke with the local medical examiner about the fact that they literally cannot keep up with the tragedy, the horror of bodies literally piling up and crowding our local morgue, people that are felled by opioid addiction. It may seem to listeners that we're focusing on this quite a lot, and there's a reason for that, because it's a really critical public health threat, and so we're continuing to devote resources to this. Dr. Miles, you reached out after our last segment on the show because you had some information you wanted to add in terms of how your practice is seeing patients. You're in St. Mary's, Georgia, right over the state line. And we've talked a lot about the Northeast Florida tragedy, but this is a national tragedy in all 50 states.
Oh, there's no question about it. In fact, data from the American Society of Addiction Medicine shows that we had over 52,000 overdose deaths that were identified as such in 2015, which is 129 people per day. And we know this is continuing to escalate. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it is a national problem. It is a local problem. It is in your community, whether you think it is or not.
This has grown over a period of many years, and it's really escalated over the last, I don't know, 5-10 years. What do you think's driving this?
Yeah, really, if you look back, there are two principal things that started to drive this crisis. Back in right around 1990 to 94, the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Health Organizations, JCHO, proclaimed pain as the fifth vital sign. And actually, then patients began becoming surveyed. When they had been in the hospital, had their pain been adequately treated, they came up with something called the Wong-Baker scale, which everyone knows as the frowny and the smiley face pain scale. And this started to drive physicians because they would be rated down if the patient said they weren't adequately treated. And they would be rated down, and so there would be pressure from the hospital administrators and also from the patients themselves, as well as insurance companies. So they began to prescribe more opiates in copious amounts in order to try to avoid that sanction. Mm-hmm. And the second piece was the introduction of OxyContin, the prolonged or extended release oxycodone that initially was touted as not really very addictive, and then that became a huge problem. Those two things fueled it, and then as soon as those that people began to notice, legislators and whatnot, that the prescription opioids were out of control, then they began to react, shut down pill mills, so to speak, get on the back of doctors. They got on the pharmaceutical company to change the formulation of OxyContin. Well, this caused a domino effect. People didn't stop using those opioids. They then drove them to the street. and they started using heroin because it was cheaper and more available. And the heroin of today is clearly different than the heroin that was in the 70s, as is the demographic of user.
Right. It's interesting when you look at the statistics around opioid addiction. This is a problem that cuts across all demographic lines in this country, all racial categories, all income levels, Democrats and Republicans, city people and country people. This is affecting everybody.
Indeed it is. And we see now that there is a big movement afoot, particularly on the federal level. And it started with the Obama administration. But as you say, the Republicans and Democrats are all on the same page with this. And the new CARA Act that just went into effect is trying to open up more avenues of care for those who suffer from this addiction.
And that's your specialty. Let's talk about a couple of things. First, you mentioned street heroin, and in particular fentanyl, which is a particularly deadly and potent form of heroin. That's killing people in huge numbers. That's one problem. The other issue, as it seems to me in terms of how you approach your practices, is that we haven't reached a consensus yet in treating this addiction as a relapsing chronic disease. That's your contention.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there is still some stigma out there surrounding this, but the scientific data now is clear. If you look at, I'm board certified by the American Board of Addiction Medicine and a member of the American Society of Addiction Medicine, who are really the driving the research. And it's very clear that this is a chronic relapsing brain disorder, as is alcohol, as are other substance use disorders. And it's very clear that it hijacks the brain neurochemistry and rewires it, if you will. And so it is clearly, now if you look at the data, something that should be approached and looked at just like you're treating a chronic disease like high blood pressure, like diabetes. These, you know, this clearly rewires the brain, and there's also genetic components.
Some are more susceptible than others.
No doubt.
Yeah, I mean, I like to tell this story. I was just talking about this with our Morning Edition host, Michelle Corum. When I was in college, I was a freshman in college. This is back in the 80s. I had my wisdom teeth removed. They were impacted. They gave me codeine, about 2 or 3 weeks worth for pain. And that medication gives you a euphoric kind of high. I'll never forget how that felt. I was definitely in an altered state while I took those pain pills. I went back to college, and that was it. I didn't seek it out again, simply because I think I was lucky. I'm not genetically susceptible to re-seeking out that feeling of being in an altered state. But so many people are, and they are particularly vulnerable to this type of medication.
Do agree so much. In my own personal experience, for instance, in 2012, I underwent a complete shoulder replacement. The whole joint had to be replaced. And again, just like everyone who undergoes orthopedic surgery, was prescribed the strongest of the strongest and then walked down. So what I say to my patients is, why did you become addicted? And I did not become addicted. Well, it's clear there's genetics involved here.
Then what are the limits of the treatments that are currently available? And what do you think needs to be done besides making Narcan, for example, more widely available? That's had some success in saving lives. If a patient is in the midst of an overdose, medics can prescribe that. But what else, in your view, are we not doing?
Well, the push for clearly for more availability of the Narcan is a very good thing. We have to, in order to reach these people to treat the chronic relapsing disease, we have to receive them alive. So that's the first responders. And I thought your first responder, I think it was Mr. Rowley.
From JFRD.
Yes.
Yeah.
Did an excellent job last week in describing their dilemma on the streets. Where we come in on the first lines of medication-assisted treatment, there really are three or four now medications that are available that are quite effective. The first one everyone has heard of course, is methadone. And I'll talk a little bit about the history of treatment here in a minute. But Then you also have Suboxone and Subutex, which are now available to physicians who obtain what we call a Data 2000 waiver on their DEA license to prescribe, and that can be prescribed out of their office. And then you have the blocker.
But that's not as widely available, right, Suboxone?
It's not, because there's not as many physicians who have sought and received the training for that waiver.
And then there's a blocker?
Yeah, the blocker is depot form of naltrexone called Vivitrol, and it's given once a month. And it's also being used, by the way, for alcohol use disorder quite successfully, and there's ongoing studies with Vivitrol and other naltrexone preparations for the treatment of methamphetamine addiction.
Do you prescribe all of these?
I do.
Okay. And how much success are you seeing?
Well, the data would suggest that in a comprehensive program, now, I'm not talking about just giving them a prescription or a medication and saying, patting them on the head, see you in a month. I'm talking about comprehensive counseling, you know, real intervention, addressing their mental health issues, so on and so forth. We can see with medication-assisted treatment in the 65 to 70% sustained recovery rate versus other treatments that show less than 5%, you know, sustained recovery.
But you need the comprehensive wraparound treatment. You can't just give someone some pills and send them on their way.
That's absolutely correct. And in fact, if that is happening out there in practices, that will actually fuel the diversion of some of these medications that are meant to treat.
It's our ongoing look at the opioid crisis here on the show. 549-2937. Robert is in St. Augustine. Hi, Robert. Good morning.
Good morning. First, Melissa, I'd really like to say that you made a statement earlier that was just, it staggered me when you said that the morgues are having a hard time keeping up with the bodies piling up from opioid overdose doses. To me, that sounds, and this is so prevalent across the United States, that some serious questions need to be asked about the whole process of prescribing, the whole reasons for prescribing, the after effects of prescribing, and I know this is the topic of the conversation here, but the statistics are just overwhelming to the point of, this is not just a national health crisis, this is a national emergency. The number of people dying is a national emergency. And my question is, what is the percentage of people that you're seeing that are dying from opioid overdoses, of people that are just simply being prescribed opioids as opposed to illegal use?
Thanks, Robert. Sure. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's a great question, Robert. And actually, the data are quite alarming, although this seems to be improving with the new regulation that's come down. Right now, the data would suggest that 60 to 70% of the overdose deaths nationwide are tied to prescription opioids, and the rest are illicit opioids, the heroin, fentanyl, and the other illicit street drugs.
Mm-hmm. But as you pointed out, Doctor, someone may come in after having surgery. They start with some painkillers. They get hooked. And the next thing you know, they're out buying street heroin. It's really quite horrifying. And it's millions, well, hundreds of thousands of Americans have gone this route.
Yeah, there's no question about that. And, you know, the only real answer to this is that you get all the stakeholders at the table. And when I say that, I mean those of us in the substance abuse treatment facilities, coupled with the mental health people in the community, coupled with law enforcement, coupled with the drug courts and the drug court judges, coupled with the pain clinics, everybody joining arms, coming together. Mm-hmm. Everyone has a stake in this, and there's almost no one that you can talk to that you know that hasn't been affected by this in some way.
Tracy in Mandarin. Hey, Tracy. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Lovely program. Lovely doctor. I am a physician myself. I think spending time with the patient more frequently is very important, explaining them what are the side effects. I see patients, they take one medication in three different forms, and they are not aware of It is the same thing. For example, I will give you a recent one. Patient taking albuterol, taking with the nebulizer solution, ended up in the ER. And I say, who gave you nebulizer solution? It's the same thing. He was having tachycardia. I think make these patients come more often, sit down with them, don't prescribe. I tell every patient, I can't prescribe these opiates and all that, and I can, but I take myself off the list so they don't get anything from me. In 40 years, not a single time I have written any narcotic prescription or any opiate to anybody. I take myself off the list from them. But anyhow, it's a good program. It's a sad thing. I think sit down, let them come more often to the doctor and get only 30 pills. Just for 1 week and come next week again. Thank you so much. I'll take myself off the air.
Thank you.
I couldn't agree more with you, doctor. The intervention and the FaceTime between patient and physician is extremely important. The issue, of course, that we all face in clinical practice is the pressure of reimbursements and seeing enough patients to pay the bills. And it's a tremendous conundrum, actually, for everyone to have enough time for the patients and still remain running their business. We all know that these private practices are small businesses.
John in St. Augustine. Hi, John. Good morning.
Hello.
Hey.
Good morning. Two comments that I heard earlier that I think are pertinent. Certainly, someone spoke to the difference between prescribed and off-the-street drugs, and I know there's a lot of efforts to choke down on just distribution. You also talked about getting everyone at the table. I don't think there's a continuity of care. But in particular, I wanted to comment on the behavioral health aspect. You talked about having that type of program in place as opposed to just prescribing a pill. And I'm wondering about the significance of access to that care. I think the behavioral health part and particularly the education part is underserved right now. I remember the anti-smoking campaigns of the 70s, and I'm not seeing a general awareness effort at this point. And the other part, of course, is insurance. Inpatient can cost, what, $20,000, $30,000 a month? So how do you get the average person who's teetering on the edge of having their life fall in from addiction access to care?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that is a great point, one that we are desperately trying to address in our little area of the world in Camden County, which
and how heavily, how big of a problem is this in Camden County, Georgia?
Well, we chose that location because we knew, number one, it was underserved, and number two, with our research before we opened the center, showed us that there's a tremendous problem. People were either having to drive north to Brunswick and Savannah or south to Jacksonville, both 45 minutes plus drive, and that is a barrier to care in and of itself.
You chose St. Mary's specifically to help a smaller area get better access to care for this issue.
That's correct. And our clinical chief clinical officer and our CEO have been, since the beginning, involved with the mental health community. So we have memorandum of understanding with several mental health providers so that we have places to send our patients, because 60 to 75% of these folks will have co-occurring mental health issues. And if you don't deal with both or all sides of this, their homelessness, their joblessness, if you don't have wraparound services, you're only putting a Band-Aid on it. So we are trying to build a comprehensive program that reaches all those areas that I mentioned earlier in order to really reach the underserved and the underprivileged. And we are credentialing with all the insurance plans, including Medicaid, so that we can serve the populations that need it the most, as well as those. We don't want it to be wealth care, if you will.
Here are a few tweets and Facebook comments on Twitter. Studies show opioids suppress immune system and pain relief measures increase recovery time. Is this info getting to the doctors? And here's a comment on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Didn't Florida for years fight regulations on pill mills and fight proposals for a prescription database? Opioid addiction is just that. It doesn't matter if the addict is using OxyContin or heroin, and it's not new. What part did pharmaceutical companies, doctors, and lawmakers play in advancing this problem?
Well, there's just no question that, as I said, the formulation of OxyContin which was pharmaceutical company driven, of course, helped to fuel this. It was one of the big initiating factors. I named two, no question about it. I'm sorry, what was, give me some of the other question there and I'll try to answer
it. On Twitter, that the way opioids suppress the immune system and pain relief measures increase recovery time.
Yes. You know, those things are true medical facts, which is why you have to be judicious in a post-operative patient about treating their pain, but not treating it for too long, and also being aware and stepping down the potency of the medications you're using. And yes, this information and education, there's a big push nationwide to get this out to the physicians. So many of the conferences for family practice, internal medicine, all the primary care specialties is really focusing on those issues and that education.
The power of this addiction, too, is so heartbreaking. And it's been brought home to all of us when we see celebrities felled by it. The death of Prince, the death of acclaimed actor Philip Seymour Hoffman, and we found out after their death that both of those men were trying to get clean but kept relapsing.
Yes, and that's a great point. Those, you know, when someone famous dies, it puts a big light on it. It's no, of course, they're no more important than everyone else who's dying. But the biggest risk of overdose death, and this is what people need to understand, comes when someone has been completely detoxed, their receptors downregulate, then they relapse within the first week after that detox, and they go back and use the same amount they used before, and it's laced with fentanyl, benzodiazepine, carfentanil, sufentanyl, which are orders of magnitude more potent, and they go to sleep and they don't wake up.
And you see that a lot.
It's happening everywhere. And this fentanyl now, the chemists have figured out how to make this. So they make it in illicit laboratories, much the way they do methamphetamine. And it's so now readily available. And the heroin dealers purposely cut their heroin with these stronger things, because there's a competition, of course, on the street. If they can have produce the drug with a better high, then they have more business. And this is killing people.
Karen is in San Marco. Hi, Karen. Hey, Karen, go ahead.
I had a question regarding hyperalgesia, and that is when the body regulates to cope with the medicine, particularly, I think, OxyContin. And I've read something. I have two family members where one, it seems to treat the pain, and I still think that person is a bit of an addict. The other one seems to say it doesn't work and need more and more and more. Is there a difference between this hyperalgesia state some researchers are looking into? Could you speak to that? Thanks.
Thank you.
Yes, hyperalgesia simply means the body has a very heightened response to pain. And we know that pain is both objective and subjective. So there are many subjective components to it. I think what we need to understand is that people in pain management will become dependent upon these opioids, but not necessarily addicted. And I think let's make a quick differentiation. Dependence means that you're on a medication of some kind. In this case, we're talking opioids. And when you remove it, there is a withdrawal syndrome. Addiction is the dependence plus what we call the three C's in addiction medicine. Compulsion to get it, craving to use it, and continued use of the drug despite adverse effects on your health, on your personal life, on your finances, et cetera, as it goes. So the hyperalgesia, I might also add that now the studies also show that in treating chronic non-cancer pain, there is no evidence that long-term use of opioids actually decreases or is a good management for long-term chronic non-cancer pain, and that actually it may lead to that hyperalgesic state because your receptors in the body have been chronically exposed to those opioids.
Paula writes on our show Facebook page, please discuss the secondary dangers of addiction. A good friend was prescribed opioids for chronic pain due to a broken back. He's fallen into and climbed out of and fallen back into the opioid hole countless times. He's descended to converting them to an injectable form, and due to the difficulty of getting fresh needles, has contracted septicemia, which the doctors are running out of antibiotics to treat. He's in the hospital right now, and he may not make it to the weekend.
Right. So the question really is, what are the risks? And that scenario you describe is all too common. All right. Anytime someone's injecting into their body, you have this risk. Septicemia is merely a bacterial infection in the blood that spreads everywhere, and primarily in addicts, it will land on the heart valves. But you also have the risks, of course, of HIV and AIDS. You have the risks of hepatitis A, B, and C. You have then, of course, beyond that, the other risks to personal relationships, okay? You have the risks to your finances. You have
get fired from your job. I mean, your life becomes utterly destroyed.
Absolutely.
Let's go to John in St. Augustine. Hi, John. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Hi, thank you for taking my phone call. I was wondering if you could speak to the efficacy or what the data is showing the efficacy of cannabis is to curb the opioid epidemic.
Okay, cannabis.
Okay, that's a great question. In fact, I just finished a ASAM state-of-the-art course, and there was a huge section on cannabis. And because cannabis is still what we call a Schedule One, which means you have to have special permission from the federal government even to engage studies, we don't really know the answer to that question. We know that it helps, clearly helps some, but there's no good research because of this scheduling of it.
Let's take one more call on the opioid crisis. Eric is in Mandarin. Hi, Eric. Good morning.
Hey. Yeah. I just had a quick question. I was kind of wondering sort of where, I guess, personal responsibility kind of fits into this equation. I'm a nurse, and I see a lot of post-operative patients, and when they go home with pain medication, almost like all of them taper off. We kind of instruct them to taper off. Most of them do it themselves. And like I remember a study, it might be a little bit dated now, but that they give really high doses of opioid pain medications to children, like higher than they would even for adults with like children with cancer and stuff like that. And only like 3% actually get addicted because they're actually treating the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that it seems to me that when like a lot of these problems come from people that, you know, maybe like, you know, get their teeth removed and like they give them like, you know, 30 pills of, you know, Percocet, which, you know, is more than they need, and then they have a lot of extra, and then kind of gets in the hands of, you know, recreational users. So that would be kind of my thought. And, you know, I'd love some, you know, actual evidence, which I'm sure you guys got to, you know, contradict me.
No, not necessarily. Thanks for the call. That's a nurse, Eric, calling. Right. So, doctor.
Yeah. Again, I think that goes back to the whole stigma that this is a moral failing, that this is a moral weakness, a weakness of character, and the data is not substantiating that. Do we have personal responsibility once we identify that we have a problem then to enter into proper treatment? Sure we do. But on our side, we need to understand and out there, these families that are affected by this, that you know, these folks have genetic predispositions. This is the reason that some become addicted to these medications after a surgery, like he refers to, and others do not. And we need to treat it as a chronic relapsing disease and have open access for them to get into treatment.
We're going to continue our look at the opioid crisis on this program throughout the year. And we thank you so much for being with us today. He's Dr. Scott Miles, Medical Director with Coastal Community Behavioral Health in St. Mary's, Georgia. Thanks for driving down to be with us.
Thank you, Melissa, for having me.
Keep in touch, please.
Yep.
Much more still ahead later. Musician John Ginty with a live in-studio performance. But up next, Florida Blue CEO Pat Garrity talks about his trip to Davos, the World Economic Forum. Back in a moment.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
On February 14th, the full Jacksonville City Council is expected to take up a controversial change to the city's human rights ordinance. Join WJCT for a live, interactive, televised discussion as a panel explores the division over the expansion of Jacksonville's human rights ordinance protections for the LGBT community. Community Thread, LGBT Rights on the First Coast. Wednesday night at 8 on WJCT-TV and 89.9 WJCT-FM.
I'm Joshua Johnson. On the next 1A, the legal fight over President Trump's travel and refugee bans. The president says a federal judge is putting the nation at risk by blocking the ban on travel from seven mainly Muslim countries. It's the first major legal battle of his presidency. Neither side shows any signs of backing down. The courts, the Constitution, and how to keep the country safe. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, it's the annual meeting of the world's global business and political elites. The World Economic Forum, or Davos, as it's also known in Switzerland, has also been the subject of growing criticism in recent years as populist concerns about income inequality grow. One local business leader attended Davos and has some thoughts for us about the whole confab. We spoke about what he learned as we welcomed Florida Blue CEO Pat Garrity. Take a listen. Pat Garrity, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here, Melissa.
So this is your second year attending the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, or Davos, as it's known, the global elite coming together to talk about the world's most difficult problems. What was on the agenda this time?
Well, there were a number of things on the agenda. For me, the focus is around what are the global health issues that we're talking about. And in particular, there was attention on epidemics and Zika.
Okay. Of course, here in Florida, we're really concerned about Zika. What was your contribution to that, and what did you learn?
Well, certainly, I want to make sure the emphasis is on Zika and that we are getting a lot of focus there. It was really important that the group of people that are coming together and driving this include Bill Gates. And Bill Gates has been instrumental in the group already having raised $750 million on its way to $1.6 billion for world preparedness around epidemics. Uh-huh. And one of the issues is Zika and really the search, if you will, for a vaccine, which we don't have today. Very important work.
How concerned are you about that, in particular as the virus spreads from South Florida, where it has taken hold at least a little bit and could migrate northward?
Yeah, tremendous amount of concern. You know, at this point, the tools are limited other than awareness and education and people taking the right precautions. And we try and educate and be involved with the public health services around the state to do our part as a health company in the state. But really, a vaccine is what we all need, and that's something we're focused on trying to emphasize.
How close are researchers to developing one that might be effective?
Hard to say at this point. Yeah. I think there's a lot of work going on, but it's early stage.
Okay. And so you mentioned epidemics, not just Zika, but Zika is at the top of your list. What are the other big health concerns that you see as something that world leaders need to put a stronger focus on?
You know, one of the things you really appreciate when you're in that setting is how quickly an epidemic from anywhere in the world can travel. Given the flexibility, the travel schedules of people all over the globe, you can have something that comes out of Africa, comes out of Southeast Asia, that can move across multiple countries and literally the globe in very short period of time. So right now, there's the bird flu in China. Mm-hmm. That's something that can move rapidly around the globe. And so everyone needs to be on alert, aware of what's happening in all settings around the globe and making sure that we collectively do the right things to get information out, to have prevention in place, and to make sure that health officials everywhere are connected mm-hmm. from a data transmission standpoint and make sure that we collectively are focused on all of those issues.
Sure. And at Davos, all of this was discussed. A lot of items on the agenda, though, at the World Economic Forum, and in particular this year, there seemed to be a real sort of backlash about Davos, which features some of the world's wealthiest, most privileged people, anger about income inequality, the loss of middle-class jobs, automation. How big of an issue do you think this is for the credibility of this forum? Because it's coming under increasing criticism.
Certainly the all of the institutions of the world seem to be under criticism of one form or another. Yeah. What I find in Davos is that you have a mixture of people. You have young folks who are being sponsored to be there. You have people from all over the world, some of them who are being sponsored by organizations to be there. So you get a tremendous mix of people. Yes, you have some of the world economic elites there, but you have leaders from all over the globe. And let's face it, the people who come to Davos, from my point of view, even if they are from the economic elite, are there because they care and are trying to solve this issue. So, you know, the financial inequality in the world is an issue that is getting a lot of attention. As we move to a more automated world, we have to look at what does that do to jobs? What does that mean for retraining of people and giving them skills and opportunities in the new economy? And frankly, I saw a real interest in solving for that issue in Davos. And it's one of the forums where people are looking ahead, not waiting for it to happen, trying to plan policy and discussions that are, I think, quite sensitive to those kinds of issues.
Right. The head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, spoke at a session called Squeezed and Angry, How to Fix the Middle Class Crisis. So there was some attention given to these issues at Davos. Even still, activists are saying, you know, do more, don't be tone deaf to the concerns of middle class people. As this forum continues next year, do you plan on going? And in addition to the health issues, how much more of these types of themes do you think we'll be seeing?
Well, I think there will be more of those kinds of themes. I try and concentrate on the health track and then add some other things to my plate as possible. Mm-hmm. There are lots and lots of sessions that are going on concurrently there, so you can't get to everything, but you do try and get to some of the general sessions as well. I think the forum needs to take as strong a focus as it can on not just having the conversation, but affecting change, which is what I loved about the epidemic discussion and how Bill Gates has sort of motivated that group to truly take action. Yeah. And so to the extent that I'm involved in discussions, it will be around how do we take this discussion and then put it into practical application to change that what's happening around us.
Well, thanks for sharing your experience with us.
Happy to do it. Thank you.
That's Florida Blue CEO Pat Garrity. Well, they're a hidden cultural gem here on the First Coast. Friday Musicale, a unique venue in Riverside that's been around since 1890. But word is getting out about a big event coming up at the beautiful space. Naomi Sheridan, executive director, and Jeff Tawney, venue director with Friday Musicale, are here with a preview of Sip, Sup, and Swing. Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for allowing us to be here today. Yes, we're very excited about our upcoming event featuring the Chris Thomas Band. It is
very popular guy.
Absolutely.
Yes, he is.
It's going to be on Saturday, February 18th. Starting out 6 p.m. cocktail hour with raffle auction, dinner, very amazing. And I'll let Jeff share a little bit about our seated dinner.
Thank you. The seated dinner basically is going to be in our secondary venue next door, which is called Lingle Hall, and with wine service. And we'll have music, of course. And then afterwards, the party really begins back next door in the main auditorium with the Chris Thomas Band.
All right. So a great event with live music, lots of drinks and food. And this is all to support Friday Musicale, Naomi, which is a beautiful, gorgeous event space in Riverside and has been part of Jacksonville since 1890. It's
Absolutely.
Really incredible.
Yes, and it's also the Ladies of Jacksonville founded this organization, as Melissa mentioned, 127 years ago. with the intention of offering free concerts. We still offer free concerts, as well as this event is supporting our educational outreach programs for youth, as well as master classes with the artists that come in from around the country.
And Jeff, we're talking an incredible array of talent that's passed through these doors over the last century and 25 years plus. I mean, it's extraordinary.
Exactly. Yeah, it is amazing to think about it, the amount of concerts that they've actually put on since, you know, back in the beginning. But on average, is about 25 concerts spread between October through May, which are open to the public and free of charge. We are a nonprofit organization as well, which a lot of people don't realize that. So we rent our buildings out for corporate and social events, and the money goes towards funding all of our different programs, including the concert program. We have a scholarship program for high school seniors who are going on to study music in college, and they compete against each other. And then we have smaller programs too. We have a program called the Young Pianist Program, where you'll have kindergartners competing against seniors in high school for cash prizes. So it's really fun.
Oh, fun. And I've often thought of Friday Musicale as sort of a hidden gem, but bringing in the Chris Thomas Band is really splashing out for you guys. He's got a big local following, and people tend to think of Friday Musicale as classical music, but it's not just that.
Absolutely. And one of the intentions is with the Chris Thomas Band is that we want to have a very enjoyable, amazing party. The additional component piece is we are branching out a bit in our concert offerings, adding on jazz offerings, gospel, world music, with the foundation being classical, because that's how it was founded.
So this is a way to support an incredible cultural gem, Friday Musicale. This is coming up next Saturday, February 18th, Sip, Sup, and Swing with the Chris Thomas Band. He's going to be in his glory with his full band.
Yes, yes.
He's like a 20-piece band, doesn't it? I mean, it's incredible.
Well, at least for us, because of space, it will be 8-piece.
Okay.
And that still is going to be amazing.
He's very high energy, that's
yeah,
for sure.
We're excited about it.
Yeah, get your tickets now for Sip, Sup, and Swing next Saturday at Friday Musicale. They are on Oak Street in Riverside, live with the Chris Thomas Band. It's FridayMusicale.com. Naomi Sheridan and Jeff Taney, thanks for being here. Have fun.
Thank you so much.
And speaking of music, keep listening, because in a moment, we've got a live in-studio performance from New Jersey's own John Ginty as he plays the Mudville Music Room tonight. That's in a moment.
WJCT's Travel and Entertainment Auction is where you'll find over 300 items, most starting at a fraction of their value at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. The bidding begins February 9th and continues through February 20th. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information. Bid now. The auction continues through February 20th at 8 p.m.
On the next Fresh Air, a look inside one of the biggest insider trading scandals in history. New Yorker staff writer Sheila Kolhatkar talks about the investigation into the hedge fund of billionaire trader Steve Cohen. Her new book, Black Edge, explores how Wall Street's elite accumulate wealth and the implications for the rest of us. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, New Jersey's own organist John Ginty is playing the Mudville Music Room tonight in Jacksonville with his John Ginty Band. We've got a special treat. The whole band is live in studio right now. Hey, John Ginty Band. Good morning, you guys.
Good morning. How are you doing, Melissa?
I'm doing great. And I'm so excited. You're all in studio, ready to play live. Now, you're going to be in concert tonight at Mudville. Really exciting. Now, you're on tour here in Florida to support your new album. Tell us about it.
Yeah, we are. We got a new record coming out February 17th called Rockers. And we've been running around the South here. We started in Georgia last week, and we're running through Florida. And we got another week in Florida here, and the weather's beautiful. We're all from New Jersey, where it's cold and snowy. And
right.
So we've been having a great week. All the shows have been excellent. The people have been coming out. It's beautiful.
Excellent. Well, we're pleased to have you in town. Now, you just came off a tour playing the Hammond B3, is that right, for the Dixie Chicks?
Yeah, that's right. The Hammond B3 is my main keyboard instrument, and I just did the Dixie Chicks world tour for the last 9 months, about 80 shows and all over the place. And I got 2 more months to go. We're going to Australia in April. So, yeah, it's great. It's a really fun gig, and the music is great. It's a fun tour. I really had a blast this last year. And in between breaks, just working with this new singer, Astor Phoenix from New Jersey, who's here today, who got up bright and early this morning to come and sing for you.
Excellent.
And, yeah, no, it's been really cool.
What attracts you to this instrument? You know, people tend to think of the organ as kind of formal and stuffy, but you really rock out with it.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's kind of a mystery because my grandmother was an organist. She played a Hammond professionally, and she passed away like 5 years before I was born. So somehow it made it through the bloodline to where now I'm a professional organist.
Huh.
It's tough to explain. I just kind of gravitated towards the instrument, though.
And you've really bent it to your will, right? You make a whole new sound come out of it.
You could say that.
I can't wait to hear it. This is such a special treat because the whole John Ginty band is in the studio right now. They're going to play for us. This is a preview of their show tonight at the Mudville Music Room. What are you going to play, guys?
We're going to play a song off the new record called Captain Hook.
Here they are, the John Ginty Band.
Slay me with your song. They were always said in vain. In the name of the law, better keep that pistol down. Better not play on cord. And all hands on deck, all due respect. Now and take a look, Captain Hook, there's a bad vibration. Seems like it's coming from our previous location. Take a look, Captain Hook, we got a situation. A nation found funk, man, the battle stations. Those lies do you no good, and you can keep those things from pirates when it's all carved out on wood. Better raise both thumbs up high, better keep your toes on edge, and all eyes on you. The final pledge and take a look, Captain Hook, there's a bad vibration. Seems like it's coming from our previous location. Take a look, Captain Hook, we got a situation. A nation found funk, man, the battle station. Situation, a nation found funk, man. and the battle stations and take a look, Captain Hook. Oh. And take a look, Captain Hook. Take a look.
It's the John Ginty Band with Astor Phoenix. That was gorgeous.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us. This was really fun.
What a treat for our listeners. Go see them tonight. Tonight, it's John Ginty and his band and singer Astor Phoenix at the Mudville Music Room. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app and listen anytime. Next on 1A, a look at everything that's happened since President Trump signed an executive order implementing an immigration ban. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again tomorrow at 9 a.m. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.